You're listening to Trek FM.
Welcome, Niners, to another episode of The Orb, our dedicated Star Trek Deep Space Nine podcast. I'm Christopher Jones, and I'm sitting down today for Arachtigino with my co-host, Matthew Rushing. Now, Matthew, is that a Jacarine pill I see in your Arachtigino there?
It is. I try to take it the same way that all the characters do at one time. It's also double strong and double sweet, the same way Miles likes his Arachtigino. So I'm going to be flying by the end of the night.
I bet you are. So you put a Jacarine peel in a double sweet Arachtigino.
Yes, while eating a Jemgesic.
Oh, wow. You're going all out there. You're going to be wired by the end of this show.
Yeah. Well, I'm planning to run to Russia over the water. Just because, and then head back. I'm a little bit like The Flash when I've had this much Arachtigino. So, yeah, it's going to be an epic night.
All right. Well, last week, we talked about our first impressions of Deep Space Nine. We remembered the premiere of Emissary and the lead-up to the show. And we talked a bit about the general premise. And what we want to do this week is we want to talk about the characters. Matthew, who is your favorite character on Deep Space Nine?
This is really hard for me to boil it down, you know, to one favorite character. I have a lot of characters on this show that I really, really like. But when I was thinking about this week in preparation for what we were going to talk about, I really came down to, you know, Sisko is not only my favorite captain, but I think he's also my favorite character on Deep Space Nine. And I know a lot of people, he's not maybe their favorite, they don't necessarily enjoy him as much. But what I love about this man is that there's so many different facets to him. He's a father, he's a chef, he's a man who has deep emotional wounds and allows them to show. He gets a chance to grow through those during the series. And so I think that Sisko, for me, was a real standout from the very beginning, as we talked about last week. This is a different type of captain. I mean, he also starts off as a commander, so we actually get to see him in two different roles get promoted. And so I really enjoy watching, every time I watch through Deep Space Nine, the progression of Captain Sisko.
Captain Sisko is an interesting character because he's very human. And as we talk about Deep Space Nine, we talk about how this show takes on real life in a way that the other shows don't. He's the perfect captain and the perfect, as you said in the beginning, commanding officer of the station, of this community that he has to lead, because he really is human. You know, you said he's a father. And you get to see the struggles that he has being put in a tough situation, having to raise a son as a single parent, while at the same time he has to deal with just crazy situations going on around him all the time. You know, the antics of Quark, the hostility of Kira, the role he's been thrust into by Kaio Paka at the beginning, of being the emissary to the Bajoran people. I mean, he arrives there. He doesn't really want to be there. He arrives. He sees it's a very tough environment. He thinks he might have to leave. And at the same time, on top of all that, the kind of the weight of the world is put on his shoulders, the world being Bajor, where he's being told, you're here to save our people. It's overwhelming, and it's something that we really don't see thrust upon many other characters in Star Trek, and even the captains.
As much as, you know, you see Kirk dealing with things, Picard, Janeway, I think I really liked the analogy that he's had the weight of the world on his shoulders. More than any other character in Star Trek, I feel like Sisko is Atlas. He's always carrying around something very heavy. And you can kind of see it in everything that he does in a lot of ways. And that, I think, does really resonate with us today very much so, because so many of us feel like there is so much we're carrying around. And so it makes him a very relatable character. And then, you know, when Sisko is joyful too, there's, you know, it's one of those things, there's not much else like it, you know, when he's having people over and he's cooking and he's just in his element. You know, again, somebody who's so human. This is a captain who wasn't afraid to get to know his crew and have them over for dinner and, you know, pretend like he likes them and actually have real relationship with them. And not just, you know, somebody like Dax, but he does this with all of the crew by the end, and they're really family. And then I really liked this character because Sisko, I think, is a really good father. He raises his son in a way that allows Jake to become his own person. He doesn't thrust himself onto his son and make him follow in his footsteps, as you know, so many children we have seen in Star Trek just kind of go the Starfleet route. But I loved that, you know, Jake has this creative side and he decides that this is what he wants to do with his life. And instead of being just another Starfleet officer, but they have a relationship, you know, it's very close. And you can tell, obviously, that Avery and Sirach were very close in real life. I think that that's what really made me like that relationship, because if they hadn't had that chemistry, it would have been just okay. But they really put it over the top, I think, by, you know, actually having a real relationship together, very father and son anyway. So, all of that to say, I think that Sisko is just a fantastic character. And he gives you something to watch every week, even in bad episodes that, you know, just move along home, or, you know, he's doing something that's interesting, or when he hits Q in the face.
Well, for me, Sisko is one of my favorites for sure. For me, it's a toss-up, possibly, and it's tough because there are so many characters on Deep Space Nine that are fleshed out as well. But it's a toss-up possibly between Kira and Garak.
Mm.
As far as the main characters go, the main characters, as in their names, are in the opening credits, because you could easily argue that Garak is a main character on Deep Space Nine.
Very much so.
But as far as the main characters go, I really like Kira, and I love Nana Visitor's portrayal of Kira. We finally see a female character on Star Trek who is portrayed equally with the male characters in a commanding position. You know, Kira is Sisko's first officer, but there's such a conflict between the two of them. They're both such strong characters. They both have such strong convictions. And Kira's never afraid to step back from that. And the way she's written from the very first moment that we see her in Emissary, she has such strong conviction and internal conflict, and she's struggling with the events of her past. And she's very, very resistant to that change. But she knows that maybe change is necessary for the good of her greater goal. And I just like the strength and conviction of her character. And a little bit later in here, we're going to talk about character arcs. And she is also a character who I think had a great arc through the series.
I do like Kira a lot, said last week, it's actually, as we've been watching through my girlfriend, that is her favorite character as well, because of the things that you mentioned. And you're right, you know, lots of times too, even in Star Trek, we don't really get strong, confident women that aren't just playing a man. You know, Kira is very much a woman all the time. And at the same time, she has this strength that you don't want to mess with. And I really liked that. And I can really respect the writers for bringing that out. And of course, Nana Visitor just, you know, she really acts that character so well. She just is Kira. You never for a moment think that this woman doesn't exist.
Oh, right. That's the thing is, yeah, when you see Kira, you don't feel like Nana Visitor's playing this character of Kira. At least I don't. I feel like this is a real person that exists, and she went through this occupation, and I'm following her journey forward through life. It's really one of the best acting performances in all of Star Trek, I think, Nana Visitor as Kira Nerys Reese.
Definitely.
Now let's talk about Garrick for a minute. I know he is a favorite of mine. He's a favorite of many, many Star Trek fans, many, many Niners. From the very moment in past prologue when we meet Garrick, when he walks up to Bashir, you knew that this was a special character. How did you feel about Garrick?
What I like about Garrick is that from the moment he comes on screen, Andrew Robinson brings a performance that lets you know that this is a character to be reckoned with. And it's one that you're never going to be quite sure you know everything about him. And that is just an amazing performance, the whole series. And especially where you end up with Garrick at the very end. You know, as somebody who is fighting on the side of the Federation for the, you know, survival of his people and the psychological trauma that he goes through because of it. I just think is an incredible acting performance, but just story. And yes, Garrick gives you so much to watch throughout the seasons because, you know, you're never quite sure exactly where he's coming from, what his angle is, and he's always got an angle. But it makes for fascinating character study with him. And as Una McCormick, author, loves Garrick as well, and she's written a couple books featuring him. And, you know, when we talked about it on Literary Treks, she said that, you know, this is why she likes Garrick is, you know, you just don't necessarily know, but he's got so much going on underneath the surface. You can do incredible things with that.
Oh, definitely. And it's amazing that Garrick appeared in 33 episodes of Deep Space Nine. And I would actually say only 33 episodes because you feel like he's there all the time. Whereas he's actually there for, what is that, roughly about 20% of the episodes.
And I think that that's one of the strengths of this show is that it can have these side characters. But by the end, you feel like that they've been more a part of the show than they have. And they've kind of taken on a life of their own. And so they've been able to go on in non-canon novels and all of those kind of things because you've created such a vibrant character. And you know, that's just the beauty again. We talked about this last week, and I don't want to go down that same road, but this is just the beauty of Deep Space Nine.
Another thing they did with Garrick and why he's a great character is, again, you never quite know what he's going to do. You never quite know what the motivation is. And they set him up as a former member of the Obsidian Order, but yet we see him working with and helping the Federation. And that's another one of those shades of gray moments in Deep Space Nine. On the Next Generation, it would have been Obsidian Order bad, Federation good. But here you see how one person can be caught between ideals, caught between principles and motivations, and how they have to work out what's best for their own personal lives as well as what's best for their families, for their home worlds, if we put it in our own terms, our countries, friends and family. And we get all of that rolled up in just a brilliantly conflicted character in Garrick.
Well, and one of the neat things about him is that he is the quintessential Cardassian. He loves Cardassia. He loves his people. He loves what Cardassia has offered to the galaxy when it comes to art and science and just all of those things. He is for his people. And yet he has seen, I think, by the end of the show, the mistakes that they've made as a people. He's seen the mistakes that he's made as one of them, and how far maybe they have to go to kind of recapture some of that that he really does love. And I think, you know, Cardassia became one of the most interesting, one of the most intricate races that has ever been in Star Trek. You know, so many people love Klingons, but honestly, the depth of Cardassians is something that continually blows my mind every time I'm watching through Deep Space Nine.
Yeah, Cardassia was a case where they showed us how there are many different walks of life, and the Cardassians are ultimately portrayed the way that you would expect any society to be portrayed. I know not everyone is a spy, not everyone is a military officer, but instead, you know, there are many, many walks of life. So we got a depth there that we really never got with the Klingons, just a tiny bit. There was an effort made here and there with Klingons to show us that not everyone was a warrior, but they're a pretty two-dimensional race, despite the fact that they have appeared so much in Star Trek. But Deep Space Nine did a great job of fleshing out Cardassians. Well, why don't we talk about some of the other main characters? Who are some of the other characters besides Sisko and Kira that you enjoy watching on the show, that you felt grew through the show?
For me, you know, it had to be Miles and Julian. And I put those two
bromance
together. Yeah, the bromance.
Yeah, Miles and Jules.
I put those two together, though, because it's such a great story, you know, of... You know, there are not, let's be honest, in our culture today, men struggle to be friends and to be close friends a lot of times. And I really liked that Deep Space Nine just portrayed the beauty of platonic male friendship. And it is okay to have somebody that you can go to, that you can complain to about life, you can complain to about work, that you can have a good time with, that you can have a beer with, that you can have ridiculous hobbies with, whether it's storming the Alamo or saving Britain, and that's okay, because this is another facet that sometimes we miss out on because we kind of hold back on that. And I loved these guys, and partly because they reminded me of the best friend that I have, and you know, that we did all this kind of crazy stuff together, and we had a great relationship, and that was just a beautiful picture of something that I had experienced in my own life and was always really thankful for. And they're just hilarious. I mean, when they're sitting in, you know, the Defiant set, but they're sitting inside Sloan's mine, and of course, you know, they're talking about whether or not Miles likes Julian more than his own wife.
Right.
You know, he loves his wife, but he likes Julian more. You know, one of the best scenes I've ever seen in any show. And it still makes me laugh like crazy every time I see it. Because, you know, I think we might have all thought that a little bit, maybe about our best friend before.
Well, I tell you, that scene is perfect because, you know, as we always say on the Ready Room, Keiko knows what's going on and she's fine with it.
and you know, along with those two, I'm gonna throw out a character that a lot of people don't like, but I love Ezri. I really, from the moment she steps on screen, I love that character, and the reason I did is because I got to see a whole other side of what it meant to be a Trill, and one that wasn't so together. And I also got to see a character grow in a season, and I thought that, you know, they might have spent a little bit too much time on Ezri sometimes in that seventh season, but by the end, she was almost a fully rounded character as much as anybody else who was standing in Vix. And I really appreciated that.
I just love her
as a character, so.
I have trouble getting on to the Ezri bandwagon myself, largely because we just didn't spend enough time with her for me.
Yeah.
You felt like at that point, all the other characters had grown so much, and suddenly there's this new character thrown into the mix. And from a writing standpoint, it's tough because you're trying to find a way to integrate this new character with this cast of 20-something characters that we already know. And I do think they spent a little bit too much time on Ezri. You know, I personally, my first experience with Ezri was a little bit later into season 7 in Field of Fire, because I was living in Japan, well, as I do now, but this was when I kind of first moved over here, when Deep Space Nine season 7 was starting, and I wasn't able to see the beginning of season 7 in first run. And the first episode that I did get my hands on happened to be Field of Fire, and it was an Ezri-centric episode that had nothing to do with the storyline that was taking place overall on Deep Space Nine, and I found it really weird. But I did warm up to her a bit, and I know that they've gone on to really flesh her out in the novels as well.
Yes.
So for me, I think Miles has to be one of them. And it's largely just because he's that ordinary guy on the station.
Yes.
And I love Colmeny as an actor. I love his portrayal of Miles O'Brien because it's just so real life. He's just this ordinary guy. I never feel like it's someone acting. I just feel like I'm just watching Colm, and I love the character of Miles. Now, I don't think that he grew as much through the series as the other characters did, possibly because he was already such an established character through The Next Generation. And so he provided that stability of character that Deep Space Nine needed in order to establish the overall premise of the show. You know, he and Keiko coming over, I think, was very important. And then Worf's arrival at the start of season 4 also helped to deliver that familiarity. But I do love Miles quite a lot. I also really like Quark. And I know a lot of people think that Quark and the portrayal of the Ferengi is ridiculous on Deep Space Nine. But what I like about Quark is that Armin Shimerman's portrayal and the take that the writers put on Quark, they were able to course correct the disaster that the Ferengi were on The Next Generation with this one character. Because
definitely.
Quark is, yes, he believes in profit. Yes, he believes in the rules of acquisition. And he likes to put up this front. You know these people in your life who put up a front, like they want to portray themselves in a certain way, like they don't care about anything. But really, Quark tries to put on that front as well. But in the end, he really cares about his brother. He really cares about his friends. And although he'll go to extremes for profit, you see that that he is not a cardboard cutout himself. And he adds a depth to the Ferengi that allow them to be used at times for important messages and at other times for comedic relief, which if a show ever needed comedic relief, it's Deep Space Nine, because it gets really, really heavy at times. And
definitely.
So I like Quark for that reason as well.
Quark is a fun character, and what makes him great, too, is to see his own bromance with Odo. You know, they have very yes. much their own bromance, and I think this show is kind of
a different
with
kind
exactly.
from Miles and Jules.
Exactly. They definitely have the more adversarial bromance, but they definitely respect and kind of cherish each other's friendship in a way that you wouldn't expect when you first start watching the show. But as it goes on, you know, Quark and Odo have this kind of begrudging respect for one another that actually turns into something even deeper by the time the show ends. And you're right, Quark can say a lot about us because Ferengi specifically are kind of the representation of all that's wrong, I guess, in America.
Well, it's capitalism and greed run amok.
Yes, exactly.
Yes. To say that capitalism is bad, but capitalism run amok can lead to some disastrous situations, as we've seen in recent years.
Right, exactly. And I really do, honestly, I think that that's appreciated. You know, we need to be able to look at ourselves in that kind of lens and say, okay, what is wrong with us? And you're right, we have seen the fall of our capitalistic system because of insane amounts of greed.
Right.
So I'm sorry, Gordon Gekko, but greed is not good.
You know, Odo and Quark is a great thing because if you watch from the beginning of the series, I was really impressed with how the writers were able to handle this with these two brand new characters who are so completely different from one another. And they're on the opposite side. You know, you've got the crook and you've got the law enforcement. But the conversations that Odo and Quark have from the start of season one are great. Those two characters connected so early on. And then they go through so much together over the course of the series. It's a very unexpected, but very effective combination of characters.
Well, this was something that was really interesting as we were thinking about doing this about characters. I just was looking for kind of lists of how many characters you had in Deep Space Nine. And I found this great, go to Wikipedia because that's where everything is. And this was just kind of a list that they had created. And I'll just mention some of the recurring characters you get. Baryle, Brunt, Damar, Eddington, Fontaine, Garrick, Gowron, Ishka, Moogie, for those who don't remember. You had Morn, definitely a character. Nog, Rom.
And the list goes on and on. So you can keep reading forever with this list.
Exactly.
There are so many of them. Now, Morn is a good example because what some people don't know is that they consider doing a spinoff of Deep Space Nine, and it was going to be called Late Night with Morn.
Which was going to be really good until they realized that they had never had Morn talk. And so they just didn't want to break that mystique in the same way that Home Improvement didn't ever let you see Wilson's face. Yeah. So, they figured, let's just, Joey didn't do so well after Friends. So is Morn really going to be able to, be who he is without Quark? They just didn't think it would go that way.
Well, I think it would have been good if they, he talks so much off camera. If they could just get him to speak up on camera, it would have been great. Him behind the desk, and then off to the side, his band leader, Vic Fontaine.
Oh, yeah, that would have been a great show. I think, man, we could have had some years of entertainment with that.
Now, as we talk about other minor characters that we like, Vic Fontaine, I bring him up because he's actually a minor character that I love and I know is hated by a lot of viewers.
Which I cannot understand why. And maybe it's because, confession, I'm Sicilian. I grew up with my whole mom's side of the family being from Italy. I grew up listening to the crooners. And so the moment they introduced this character, I was hooked. Because that whole, Rat Pack era is something that I grew up with and was very familiar with. And it just kind of, to me, it fits the feel of Deep Space Nine. That kind of Vegas era in the 60s, kind of out in the wilderness. It's its own thing. That's a perfect representation of what Deep Space Nine was. And you had to be there to understand it.
It is a good fit for Deep Space Nine, in my opinion, as well. Maybe we're biased. I'm a bass trombonist. I grew up playing jazz. I grew up playing big band. I love the Rat Pack. And what I like is this juxtaposition of what's going on with the Dominion War. you know, we're in the 24th century. It's Star Trek. There's all this technology. There's this very just overwhelming sense of gloom happening with this war. But yet, opposite that, you've got Vic Fontaine, you've got jazz, you've got all this fun stuff going on in the club. And putting that music against the visuals of Deep Space Nine was beautiful. And one instance for me that has always stuck with me is in the Siege of AR-558, which is a really dark story. And, you know, our heroes are in a situation which seems like they may be coming to the end of the road. And as the Jem'Hadar are approaching, you've got "I'll Be Seeing You" playing over the top of this firefight that's going on. And it's something that if they had done that without having the whole Vic Fontaine character, it would have made no sense. But by having Vic Fontaine as part of the show, creatively, it gave them the ability to do some very unique things that gave a special flavor to DS9 that, at least for me, as someone who played all of this music growing up, it gave an additional connection that I didn't get in some of the other shows.
And I think one of the things that, you know, when we talk about all of these characters, what this gives Deep Space Nine is vitality and life that doesn't necessarily exist in that kind of austere next generation world. But these are characters, and yes, you can run into that problem where Star Trek uses too many 20th century things that our characters like. You know, this is something that I really enjoyed. You know, you bring on Worf and he's got his Klingon-ness and he does his all his Klingon things, you know, so we know he uses his holodeck programs. Quark constantly is mentioning different holodeck programs that he has that all revolve around 24th century things. But then, you know, you get our human characters who enjoy human history and human things. And I don't necessarily have a problem with that, and just brings out a humanity in them that I really enjoy. So you get Sisko's a cook. He's a chef. He really enjoys food, good food, not replicated food, something you didn't see a lot in the Next Generation because they had replicators they didn't really talk about.
Except for Riker. Riker likes to cook.
Yeah.
And sing a ditty while he does it.
Exactly. So, I really like that. And I also kind of liked... when you were talking about the idea of that kind of jazz mentality, I liked that was kind of one of the carryovers you got from The Next Generation, was Riker and his jazz love is kind of carried over, and that this kind of music, you know, transcends time because the themes in it are timeless. And that's what I really like about that kind of music in general.
Oh, it does. I mean, this music is not going to go away. I believe that in the 24th century, people will still be listening to jazz. And I love the fact that it's worked in here. All right. Well, what other minor characters do you really enjoy? We don't have time to go over many of them, but what's another one that you really like?
Yeah, I'll just name a couple that I thought were really interesting. And one was, I really enjoyed the portrayal of the character of Zial, because I liked the way that it gave Kira and Dukat a chance to kind of grow and change a little bit. And then, of course, the different paths that they both take with that. I thought that was really interesting. I also enjoyed all the different actresses that played her. I thought that they were able to find somebody that kind of brought something just a little bit different as the character was growing in the timeline. And so I thought that was really interesting and good.
Let's also not forget with Zial that she provided a great character arc for Garak as well.
Yes, definitely. Probably one of the most heartbreaking things that came out of that whole arc. The other character that I really like is Martok. That character, the moment he came on screen, you know, this was a Klingon that I could get behind. You know, Worf is so stuffy, and I really enjoyed that they finally gave Worf an opportunity to kind of get out of his shell as a person and as a Klingon, by having an actual Klingon to hang out with. And Martok is not just any Klingon. You know, he's a general, but he's somebody who's afraid of his wife, you know, all those kind of things. So they gave real depth finally to Klingon character. And yeah, he's got one eye. I mean, what a guy.
I think Martok may be one of the greatest Klingons in all of Star Trek. Now, Worf grew a lot through Deep Space Nine from the time that he came on. And by the end, you know, we see more depth in Worf as well. But Martok right out of the gate. Martok, it was a great idea to introduce Martok to the show. You know, we talked earlier in our discussion here about how the Klingons weren't really that fleshed out. They're fairly a cardboard race throughout Star Trek, but Martok is a real person that you can watch, and you can feel his thoughts and you can feel his struggles. And yeah, I agree. I love Martok.
Well, with all the characters that we've talked about, Chris, that we did feel like we really enjoyed or liked, were there any characters that kind of came about that you didn't feel like worked maybe the way that the writers had hoped they would?
Yeah, the main character that I felt didn't work, and I think you may disagree with me here, is Jake Sisko.
How so?
Well, in the beginning, he obviously served the purpose of father and son traveling to this place out in the wilderness, as we talked about last week, you know, the rifleman analogy. And early on, when Jake was small, we got to see Sisko as a father. We got to see his trepidation about raising this young child in this very hostile environment. But as you said, Jake was not going to follow the Starfleet path like we generally had seen with children on The Next Generation. And as the show went on, I felt like the writers didn't quite know what to do with Jake. And They gave him this whole writing career, which I guess it works, although it felt like it kind of came out of nowhere that suddenly there's this Federation news service who's covering this war. It's an element that kind of wasn't there in Star Trek before. And that's fine. That's fine. I felt like, though, that they weren't quite sure what to do with Jake overall as the show went on. And so it's not a terrible character, but if we're talking about characters who didn't quite work, that's probably the character that stands out the most to me.
I think that you may have hit it on the head, is that they just aren't quite sure how to use him once he decides he's going to become a writer, which is fine, but you do need to find a way to make him more integral to the show. And that's the thing that's really difficult with him.
Yeah.
And I agree with you. He doesn't necessarily find a way to shine in any of that. And it's unfortunate, because I do like Sarak and what he does with the character. I like the way he portrays him. I love his relationship with Sisko. And I think it's one of the most powerful things is that the end shot of the show is Jake standing there with Kira, and that loss you feel that when will his father return? Because it started off as father and son,
right?
And it ends with just the son waiting for the father to come home,
right?
Which I know that we could talk about in another episode where Avery was not very happy about, but this is I think you're right. There is something that is missing a little bit.
Well, you cast Sarak, he's very small, and at that age, he's going to grow. You know, they're going to do a 7-year series. He's going to sprout up, and you can't play the same angle that you played in the first season or the second season with him. And as Sarak grew and grew, and therefore Jake had to grow and grow, the whole nature of that father-son relationship also had to change. And as the storyline of DS9 changed as well, and Sisko's priorities had to shift more and more towards the war, it became difficult for the writers, I believe. And so they decided to give him his own thing. They decided to make him a writer. But yeah, it was kind of, although let's not forget that his decision to become a writer did give us possibly the best episode of Deep Space Nine, at least in my top 10 all-time greatest Star Trek episodes, which is The Visitor. And that
exactly
really worked because of the fact that he became a writer. I guess you could have done it in some other way. He didn't have to be a writer necessarily, but I think it worked because of that.
We can talk about that another time, but I think that may be, as you said, if not top 5, top 10 best Star Trek episodes ever made. So
yeah, that was a fantastic one. All right. Well, let's talk about one more big thing here with characters, and let's talk about arcs. Who do you think had the best character arc through the series, from Emissary to What You Leave Behind?
I think the two that really get a chance to come full circle is Sisko and Kira. Sisko starts off as somebody who doesn't want to be on this station, doesn't want to be an emissary, doesn't want to have anything to do with this religion. And because somebody who is completely in some ways sold out to and fully embraces his role as the emissary, his role on Bajor, his role as captain to these people, this life, that's a great storyline. And then, of course, you know, as you mentioned, you have Kira, who goes from being somebody who does not want the Federation there, somebody who's grown up a terrorist, to fight for her homeland, to free it, to being the person who goes to train her old enemy and to have them save their way of life in the same way that she saved hers from them. I don't know if there's a better storyline there at all.
No, I agree with you. I think those are the two for me as well. And it's really hard to choose which one had the better arc, Sisko or Kira. They had different arcs, but they both went on incredible journeys. And we saw growth in those two characters unlike anything that we had ever seen on Star Trek. And I think anything that we've ever seen on Star Trek after that as well. Voyager, Enterprise, of course. Really, there was never anything like the journey that Sisko made and the journey that Kira made for me. The one other character I'll throw out there for a somewhat different reason is Bashir. And
good choice.
Of course, Bashir's growth is very different from that of Sisko and Kira. But Bashir in the first season is a complete mess for me. You know, he's there to be the ladies' man because, well, you've got Riker as the ladies' man on The Next Generation. You had Kirk, the ladies' man, on the original series. Well, we've got to have a ladies' man. Let's make it Dr. Bashir. You know, his very young behavior in the first season, being there in the wilderness, and he's all ready to go, and then he's always Bashiring Jadzia, as a, has become a verb for us, to Bashir someone. He's always just like drooling every time he talks to Jadzia, and it's just a bit ridiculous. And
who wasn't, though, Chris? I mean, look at her.
but not like Jules. And so, but anyway, as the series developed and as his character became more serious, and then we get into the whole genetic engineering, by the end of the series, he feels to me like a very competent doctor, a very important character within the crew. But at the beginning, I felt like he was a bit of a young... Well, he was. I mean, he was written this way. He's very wide-eyed. He's very young. But he was kind of not on top of things. You know, there's that point where Odo has to call, where's that doctor of yours? You know, the doctor needs to be there in ops, but he's nowhere to be found. And so going from that to what we got at the end of the series, I think Bashir went through very significant growth.
And I think, you know, just talking about best doctors in Star Trek, I think he is probably maybe the number one doctor, number two doctor in Star Trek. I mean, he has one of the highest success rates, I think, if we were to look at doctors.
That's a good
just
point.
The amount of people that he saves. I mean, when we think of the Quickening, he saves a whole race of people. You know, he has huge success in that. You know, he's always doing some kind of research when somebody walks into his office. He's very dedicated as a character in that. So I think that was really interesting. We actually saw a doctor be a doctor because he's always working on something research-wise, and he's very dedicated.
That's a good point. I had not really paid that much attention to that, to be honest, because we always joke about Doctor, you know, like on The Next Generation. I don't like Pulaski as a character, but we always joke about how if we were to be injured, we'd prefer to be treated by Pulaski than Crusher, because Pulaski would probably save you and Crusher would probably let you die. But because Crusher has possibly the lowest success rate of any doctor.
Which is not her fault. It's all the writer's fault.
I know. But it's a good point that Bashir faced challenges that the other doctors didn't by having to help people in the Gamma Quadrant, races that he had never seen before and that Starfleet didn't have a lot of medical background on. You know, he wasn't just on a starship treating humans and Vulcans and Andorians all the time, people who we know a lot about. Now you can argue how realistic that is, that you could go to the other side of the galaxy and cure a disease and a race of people that you've never met before. Obviously, from a scientific standpoint, that's a case where maybe Deep Space Nine does not reflect real life very well. But if we're talking about, imagine that it is possible in the 24th century, performing your job as a doctor, I think you have a really good point there about Bashir.
Well, Chris, last thing I think it would be interesting to talk about real quick is, how would you rank Deep Space Nine's crew against the other crews that we've seen?
That's a good question. It's a difficult question because it's hard to compare, because it's a very different kind of crew. You know, you've got the mix of Starfleet, Bajorans, Changeling, Ferengi, Cardassian. You've got all these people there. So maybe if we look at it as a cast, I suppose, versus the cast of the other shows, I think, and people will argue with me because most people, I think, will typically pick The Next Generation, unless it's a StarTrek.com poll in which they'll pick Voyager.
Exactly.
But I think of all of the casts, Deep Space Nine has the best ensemble cast to tell a dramatic story. The actors are fantastic. I don't think there is a single dud in the casting of any of the major characters, for sure. And even in the minor supporting characters, they just somehow, I don't know how they do it, they found so many brilliant people and put them all together. And the diversity that we get, like on Voyager, we get forced diversity. We have the Native American first officer. We have the Asian communications officer. We have the Black Vulcan. I felt like it was forced diversity. Here we have very natural, very organic Definitely. Diversity. And so for me, I think that this cast and crew ranks as number one amongst all of the Star Trek casts that were ever assembled.
I completely agree with you. I think that this is a great cast, and I think that as you watch through Deep Space Nine, it shows itself to be the best cast, because you can take any of these characters, you can do a whole show about them, and you'll want more. And as we said earlier, you end up with characters that, even though they may have been minor characters, you feel like they've been a part of the show much more than they ever have. And I think that that just speaks to the wealth of these characters, the writing on this show, and the love that the creators of this show had for Deep Space Nine itself. And so definitely one of the things that stands out to me. And yes, I completely agree. Deep Space Nine, I believe, is probably the best ensemble cast that Trek had ever created.
Absolutely. Well, that wraps up another orb. Let's tell everyone how to contact us if they want to share their thoughts on what we've talked about today. Let us know some topics you want us to talk about. You know, this we're not going to do episode reviews on this show as a regular thing. We're not going to go through each season story by story. We're going to jump around. We're going to talk about characters or technologies or just every... It's just the minutiae of Deep Space Nine. So whatever you're interested in hearing about, you know, let us know. We'll pick up on it. We'll talk about it. You can go to trek.fm/contact. There's a form there. Choose to send a message to a show and choose the orb, and that will come to Matthew and myself. And you can find us on Facebook, where we have a very rapidly growing community. That's facebook.com/trekfm. And you'll also find us talking about Star Trek all the time on Twitter under username trekfm. Now, Matthew, what do people want to find you personally?
Yes, if you'd like to follow me on Twitter, that's really the best place to find me. MattRushing02, talking about all sorts of things, of course, Deep Space Nine, along with doing the book reviews for Trek FM. You'll see me there. Please definitely follow me. Let me know you're following me, and we'll talk Trek, we'll talk books, anything you want. I'm also talking sports ball these days. My 49ers are playing this weekend, so we'll see how that goes. Hopefully they'll win so we can be in the Sports Bowl Arena. That's what they call it, right? Sports Bowl Arena?
I think so, yeah. They definitely don't call it the Super Bowl.
No, that would be utterly ridiculous.
They don't
ridiculous
do that.
Name.
No, you can't do that.
Where can we find you, Chris?
You'll find me on Twitter under username cbrianjones. That's Brian with a Y. And you'll find me pretty much everywhere in social media under that same name. And of course, I'm talking about Star Trek, but I also talk about Japan and design and technology and all sorts of stuff all the time. So give me a follow, send me an at reply, and say hello. And while you're at it, we want to invite you to go to trek.fm. We have, I believe now, 11 shows on the network covering every aspect of the Star Trek universe. So you can find all those shows there, where you'll also find me every week along with Greg Harbin on The Ready Room. And of course, you can catch Matthew and me on Literary Treks every week as well, where we talk about Star Trek books and comics.
Well, Chris, we'll let everybody go, and we'll be seeing you next time on The Orb.